Shalom and welcome to another episode of Israel Policy Pod. I'm Eli Koaz in Tel Aviv. So we're less than 2 weeks away from our annual event in New York City on Wednesday, November 13th. You can still purchase tickets to that event at our website, israelpolicyforum.org. Our keynote speaker that evening will be a member of Knesset and former Deputy IDF Chief of Staff, Major General Yair Golan. And we're so happy to have Yair Golan in studio for a pre-event interview. Yair, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. A bit about your career. Before your new job in the Knesset, you had a career of nearly 38 years in the IDF. You were commander of Northern Command. You were head of IDF Operations Directorate. You were commander of the Judea and Samaria Division, commander of the Homefront Command. Deputy Chief of Staff, obviously. Did I miss anything?
There are, you know, other assignments along the way, but, you know, it's enough.
You studied at Tel Aviv University and at Harvard in the United States.
Also in the Army War College.
Very nice.
Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
So that's Yair Golan. And earlier this year, you entered politics and joined up with Ehud Barak, his party, Democratic Israel, which then joined up with Meretz and the Green Movement with Sav Shafir, and you were number three on that list, and you recently started a new job in the Knesset. So why don't we start by telling us, how has that transition been from the IDF army uniform to the suit and tie?
Well, this is a tough question, because the process of, you know, transferring careers was tough and hard and very emotional. The election process is quite terrible, I have to admit.
And you didn't expect two of them, I'm sure, when you joined.
Not at all. I was supposed to be in a freezing period of 3 years. Mm-hmm. And just because, you know, the other election of 2019, I was eligible for, you know, for another election.
Yeah. So just for our listeners, you were not eligible because of this cooling off law actually Netanyahu passed, I believe, when he was...
It was passed during old Olmert government.
Okay, so that was to keep generals...
Out of the political system.
Because obviously generals are very popular in Israel, but because of this scenario, which had really never happened before, when we had immediate elections, you were able to run much quicker than you earlier thought.
Yeah.
And so hopefully that will be the last election for a while, but I'm not sure. And we can get into that actually right now. Let's talk just a bit about the political situation. Right now, just over a week ago, Benny Gantz received the mandate from President Rivlin after Netanyahu was unable to form a government. Benny Gantz, he met earlier this week. His negotiating team met with the negotiating team of your party. But what still most people are talking about is a unity government, which probably, by most accounts, at least at this moment, involves some sort of rotation agreement between Benjamin Netanyahu and Benny Gantz. Does your party see a place in the next Israeli government? Does it have to be a minority government that only includes Kahol Lavan, Labor, the Democratic Union, and Israel Beitenu and the Arab parties in some formula? Or are you open to joining a unity government?
Well, I think that basically there are three options. The first one is that, you know, Benny Gantz won't be able to establish a government, and then in some way the mandate will go back to Netanyahu, and he will convince, you know, Lieberman to join him and to establish a right attitude government, I would say maybe, you know, extreme right government. This is one option. The second option is the unity government. In this case, the prospects are reasonable. It could be done, but someone, or maybe more than someone, need to abandon his, you know, basic terms.
Or one of the promises he made to his
during the election process. So, because without that, no one will be able to establish a government. And the third option is to have a minority government. in this case, we could find ourselves, you know, in the government. I think this is the best option for Israel if you want to change the course of Israel, if you want to establish some sort of hope for the Israeli people. My dream is to have a government heading by Benny Gantz and Blue and White, with Lieberman, with the Labour Party, with the Democratic camp, with some sort of support of the Arab party, you know, from the outside. It's not necessarily unstable government. It could be, on the contrary, very stable government. I think this is the best of Israel, and provide a true change of course for the Israeli society.
Now, do you think it's possible to bridge the gap between Viktor Lieberman? Is obviously a part that will have to be involved in somewhat if this minority government arises. And he said before that he's definitely not going to cooperate or sit in a government with the Arab parties. And he's also mentioned the Democratic Union as a party that he doesn't want. I mean, this is, I know this is not, you're not a political analyst, but.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but, with your permission, let me, neglect for a minute, the declarations of the past. And I think that we, all Zionist parties, and the Democratic camp is for sure a Zionist, a true Zionist party, all Zionist party can sit together. We have very few differences with Lieberman concerning, all civilian matters.
Such as civil marriage, public transportation on Shabbat.
We are almost in the same line. And I think concerning, the relationship with the Palestinians, well, in this case, I'm sure that we can create the right formula in order to sit together. For instance, we can, moving forward with separation between the populations in Judea and Samaria, between Palestinians and Israelis. This is the interest of Israelis, the interest of Palestinians. So it's not so hard to bridge the gap concerning, formulating some sort of a formula in order to sit together. By the end of the day, we want the same destiny for the Israeli society. And not necessarily Lieberman is pro-annexation, because if you think what really divide right and left in Israel is only one thing, is the question of the Palestinians. What is the destiny of Israel? To annex Judea and Samaria and maybe the Gaza Strip, or to separate Judea and Samaria from, from Israel. This is their main issue, whether to annex 2.5 million Palestinians or not. So all the rest is less important. We can discuss, the two-state solution, but does it have any practical meaning tomorrow morning? I believe that the answer is no. So let's concentrate all our efforts in order to find common ground, in order to find the right formula, in order to sit together.
So on that note, during the eve before the last election, or it was the day before, Netanyahu had an emergency press conference, as he seems to do every other day during election campaigns, where he...
Every day with his own emergency.
Exactly. And this time, not the first time, he revealed a map with plans to annex the Jordan Valley and all Israeli settlements in Judea and Samaria. And
the clusters of settlements, yeah.
Yeah, the clusters. But he also expressed not only to annex the settlements in the valley, but to annex all the settlements in the West Bank eventually as part of his plan. And what's interesting, I believe he was the last MK in the Likud to express explicit support for annexation. So we have a situation here, and this was something that Netanyahu also, he wanted to do it immediately. I believe this was a report, but actually the defense establishment didn't let him go through with the plan. You have spent a lot of your career in the IDF serving in Judea and Samaria. You've seen it firsthand, countless operations you've been in. Can you talk about why annexation is so dangerous in your view, and why it's so essential for Israel to advance separation from the Palestinians? And maybe if you could also touch on what the issue would be from an annexation that would be gradual, slowly, maybe starting with the blocks, like Netanyahu is kind of suggesting. What's your response
to that? It's a multi-layer question. And just to be, you know, accurate, Netanyahu suggested, you know, to annex, you know, the Jordan Valley, not the rest of, you know, the clusters of settlements. Although it's in the air, there was no practical, you know,
there was plan. No plan. There was no map for that.
But yes, I know Judean Samaria very well. I fought in every Palestinian city during Defensive Shield operation, except Jericho. I know the Kasbahs in, you know, intimately in Nablus, in Hebron, and elsewhere. So yes, I know the terrain and I know the people from both sides. And I can tell you the following. In this case, high fences could advance the notion of good neighboring. And that's the way we should adopt. Any other solution, well, is not practical. The notion that we can annex, you know, only sea area, which means, you know, 60% of the land of Judea and Samaria, of the more than 5,000 square kilometers, well, that could be, you know, the end of any ability to separate the two populations. Separation is so important, not for tomorrow, not for the day after, but for years to come. We need to think in terms of generations. All right, what is the situation on the ground we are going to convey to our sons and their sons? That's the question. The level of hostility is very high. The potential for further violence is quite solid. So we need to think, you know, like true leaders, like leaders with a vision. What is the vision? They are not going to vanish, you know, by a miracle one day. We are not going to vanish, you know, by a miracle one day for them. All right, we need to figure out how to live together in the most peaceful way while the hostility is quite high. While we acknowledge that there is a tendency for a bit of violence, well, mainly from my perspective, mainly from the Palestinian population, groups inside the Palestinian population. All right, what to do? The only way, reasonable way, I can imagine in order to move forward, in order to promise better future to our people and probably for their people, is by separating the populations. I can compare between the situation we have before the Oslo Agreement, while we were inside the Palestinian cities, to the situation we have today. No doubt, the situation today is much, much better. I have no desire to return back to the Kasbah of Nablus. Do we want our daughters and sons to patrol inside the Kasbah of Nablus? This is our destiny? That's, you know, the vision for the Zionist movement? It's ridiculous. So, yes, historical processes, you know, moving forward very, very slowly. And in many cases, it's hard to see the outcome of the things you are doing today. Therefore, we need, you know, to create some sort of a vision between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. There are 6.7 million Jews and more than 6 million Arabs.
Million, 6 point, yeah. Roughly 50-50, give or take.
Well,
right?
And if, you know, it's 52 and 48 or something, which is, you know, I don't know, 57 and 43, it doesn't matter. It's pretty much the same. And we want a Jewish state with a solid majority of the Jewish people. It's like, you know, saying something which is really conservative. And That's the situation, the ridiculous situation we have today in Israel. The right is, you know, almost anarchist, and the left is very conservative concerning the destiny of Israel. Yes, I'm conservative concerning Zionism. I want to have a Jewish state with a Jewish majority, solid majority, with equal rights to Jews and Arabs, and with the likelihood for, you know, some sort of reconciliation between the people, because with the strong friction between the two people, well, there's no way to make the situation better than what we have today, you know, with the high level of hostility. This is something we need to move forward in order to take, you know, different direction.
You mentioned that nobody is going to talk about a two-state solution realistically tomorrow morning. I 100% agree with that. But what steps can Israel take tomorrow morning to make that
truly,
reality closer?
Truly simple. You know, I had some experience with it while I commanded Judean Samaria region. We could, you know, encircle the settlements clusters with a fence. Yeah. You know, marking maybe the future borders of Israel. That was the idea of Ariel Sharon as a prime minister. While I commanded, you know, Judea and Samaria, I started to build fences around Ariel, around Emmanuel, around Gush Etzion, from Bet Ariel to Ariel. Come on, we had tried to do it. This is something practical. All it's needed is to invest the right money in order to move forward with the project.
So you're referring to the security barrier that was built during the Second Intifada? Only 60% has been completed today, I believe, like out of the
plan?
Or is this something separate?
The fence around Judea and Samaria is pretty much, you know, finished, except in the area of Gush Etzion and south of Hebron. All the rest was completed. I think the last gap was fixed, you know, in 2017.
And there
2 years ago.
And there have been quite a few terror attacks because of the Gush Etzion gap, correct?
Yes, but I wouldn't say this is, you know, the issue is here is not about security as much as about, you know, creating emotional boundaries for the Israeli population. Borders, the physical appearance of, you know, having borders. But what we need more than that is internal boundaries that make Israeli people, even from the right to far right, acknowledge that, all right, this is Israel. Living without borders, like, you know, with small kids, it's dangerous. We need to have borders, because without borders, you know, this friction, you know, terrible friction inside the Israeli society will follow us, you know, to the far future. And this is terrible for the Israeli society. You need to remember, and we need all to acknowledge, that most of the political violence in Israel, the internal political violence in Israel, is because of the settlements issue. No other issue makes such a friction, such a conflict inside the Israeli society. And this is the main danger for Israel. It's not Iran. We used to discuss the Iranian threat as a formidable one. I have no intention to ignore the Iranian threat. I have no intention to minimize the Iranian threat. It's a serious threat. But we always dealt successfully with external threat. Sometimes more, sometimes less, but basically, the Zionist story is a story of a success, you know, coping with external threats. The most important threat to Israel is the Palestinian issue, because that issue ruined the cohesiveness of the Israeli society.
With your permission, I want to just talk about something that happened when you were deputy chief of staff where I think, I mean, for me personally, you were treated incredibly unfairly. And also the president, Rivlin, said that as well. But you were giving remarks at Holocaust Memorial Day as Deputy Chief of Staff. And you mentioned that there were trends that you saw in Israel today, which were reminiscent of things we saw in Europe in the 30s and 40s. And obviously, people on the right wing take every opportunity they can to jump and mischaracterize your remarks. In the same, I'm talking about taking remarks out of proportion, something similar happened also last month. Can you maybe just make clear what you were trying to say?
If you read or hear, you know, what I have said carefully, well, I didn't make any comparison between the situation in Israel and the situation in Germany during the 30s. I just said that some phenomenon that occurred in Israel in the last few years echoed some of the phenomenon in Europe during the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And that was in the context of the Holocaust Day. So yes, there is a reference calling for some sort of
reflection
on what we have done in the last few years in order to analyze why, for instance, you know, the moral standard in the IDF exhibits, you know, a few problems. I was not alone concerning that. I would like to say that, you know, before the speech, the chief of staff at that time, Gadi Eisenkot, said something which is a very serious one, that not every girl with the age of 13 with
a pair of scissors, right?
Yeah, is a threat, that there should be, and not every girl should be shot dead because of it. Yes, so there are problems. And if I take the incident of Elor Azaria, well, there is a problem there. Not necessarily because of the case itself, but if I look at the public attitude toward this incident, well, it was devastating. It was devastating, you know, but he was, you know, a simple criminal.
For our listeners that don't remember, Elor Azaria was the case in Hebron when an Israeli, he was an Israeli soldier who shot at point blank range an attacker, a terrorist that had already been
neutralized. Yeah, yeah. So, all right, it's not the worst case we experienced in the IDF along, you know, so many years of fighting. But the public attitude and the political system attitude, mainly from the right, was devastating. I think that we need to acknowledge that what David Ben-Gurion says in 1948, in order to survive in this complicated area, we need to keep our moral and intellectual superiority. There is no other way. And the moral superiority is more important. And moral superiority is not about comparing us to Assad regime or to militias in Iraq. This is not the issue. It's about our moral standards. Whether we are able to keep a strong feeling of justice for young people here in Israel. This is the most important thing. And concerning that, while, you know, young people, some of them from the right and some of them from the left, and all of them need to serve together in the IDF, and all of them need to conduct, you know, complicated missions in Judea and Samaria, we need to explain them that, all right, we are using minimum force in order to keep the security of our citizens. And that's it. And what we are doing is moral and right. And you can look at the mirror in the morning and see a human being who is right, who is moral, who is, ethical standards are high. it's a kind of national power which we need to enhance and support all the time. As long as the situation is so complicated, we need to keep our moral standard more vigorously. Because, you know, people in complicated situation need support. And what support them is their internal feeling of rightness. No other way. And I think that it's better to be sensitive to the moral standards rather than to be ignorant about it. I'm not hysterical. And I experience a lot of, you know, tough things in my life. I know what is to fight. I know what is to conduct, you know, operations against civilian population. I know how to do it. I did it along all my career. I know the job. And because I know it so intimately, I do understand the spirit, the core, and how to keep it along the years, over and over again, and make people, young people here in Israel, growing up with a sense of normality. Because you don't want your kids to grow up with some, you know, scars in their souls because they did unacceptable, unmoral things during the military service.
So I think someone else who definitely realized exactly what you're saying was Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister, and his the 24th Memorial Rally since his assassination. It will take place this Saturday. Yitzhak Rabin was obviously influential in the founding of our organization, Israel Policy Forum. Can you speak a bit to his legacy? What should we bring from his legacy to Israel that you see tomorrow?
Well, for me, Yitzhak Rabin is a true example of leadership. The most complicated thing about leadership is courage, is to do things which are tough, to convince your people to do the things they are not willing to do, to create a vision and to work hard in order to implement this vision. It's always against, you know, resistance. And I think Rabin was, on the one hand, very courageous person, and on the other hand, a man with, you know, with his two legs on the ground, two feet on the ground. He did understand, you know, the complexity of the situation. I remember him as a prime minister surveying any transformation of responsibility to the Palestinians. I was with him while we gave the Palestinians responsibility for Bethlehem, and then for Hebron, and then for before that, to Qalqilia. Each one of them was very interesting, because on the one hand, he had this vision, and it was clear that he's not going to negotiate the final, you know, destiny, which is, all right, you need to transfer responsibility. But on the other hand, he understood the threats, he understood the complexity, the friction between us and the Palestinians, you know, security forces. And he wanted to make sure that the practical aspect of this great vision is done by professionals. So this is about leadership, creating a vision, courage, and a strong sense of doingness. All of this, it's an example that I take with me in everything I have done in the last few years, and this is something I will take for sure for the future.
Yair Golan, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Really a pleasure. And we look forward to hosting you in New York.
Thank you. And I'm looking forward as well.
So if you haven't yet, reserve your spot at Israel Policy Forum's annual event in New York City. You can do so today. Purchase your ticket at israelpolicyforum.org. Thanks very much, and we'll catch you next week.